It's the Debate Debacle edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, Debate Debacle. Our prior correspondence on the vices of tax cuts, Canada Post Bank Redux, and a collection of salient Rick's rants. Let's begin episode 297.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords, politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical.
The cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others, and we have traveled this way before. And there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome. Tis I, Don, your skeptical philosopher and political scientist. This week's one is about the federal debates. One could be forgiven for not having our upcoming election front and center on the things to do list. After all, the writ, as it's called, is not expected to be dropped until the fall, at least according to Bill C-16. The law states that the federal election is required to be held on the third Monday of the fourth calendar year of a mandate, which in this time falls on October 19th of this year. Bill C-16 is Harper's own law, passed in 2007, to which he's yet to adhere, and this is his third election under the Act. Third time the charm. Now, by law, the minimum length of a campaign is set at 36 days, with no maximum set in stone. However, by tradition, the average is about 50 to 60 days. So what does this have to do with debates, at least of the electoral kind? Well, there's been a push by the cons to have the debates outside this period, to commence with political advertising outside this time. I dare say we've already seen election ads. Most embarrassing, the new con ad about how Harper saved Canadian jobs by bailing out GM. Well, it turns out that one of the images in this ad of a Camaro assembly plant is one in which GM announced last month it will be shutting down and moving south. So much for sound leadership or effective financial management. Let's remember, we had till early this year a major stake in GM, which it seems we not only sold out for a buck, but also kissed any chance of saving those jobs for the Canadian middle class. Anyway, this came about when the cons refused to participate in the traditional dual debates hosted by the Consortium. It's a dual debate because one is held in English, followed by the next day with one in French. It's traditional in the sense that this has been an electoral event since 1968, and the Consortium refers to a collaboration of all major broadcasters in Canada, CBC, CTV, Global, Shaw, SRC, TVA, and others. This year, unprecedented digital reach was promised through partnerships with Google, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Vine, and YouTube. This is the most watched political event, with the last debate being watched by over 14 million Canadians. This year's reach promises to be even larger, with more people watching debate than probably actually going to vote. But no, Harper in his arrogance said, "Feck you, I choose not to play with others." The cons have announced deals with Rogers, TVA, and the Monk debates to host private election debates. It is unknown what these outlets have signed up for to win Harper's favor, but I am quite certain we will find out after the damage has been done. Side note, and I may be tilting at windmills here, but part of me cannot help but feel that this is yet another attempt by Harper et al. To undermine the CBC. Because you can bet dollars to donuts that the CBC will not be one of the lucky few to have Harper bestow their airways with his presence. Anyone who listens to Radio Free Thinker knows where my political allegiance lies. That said, for the moment at least, I must take my hat off to Mr. Trudeau for not agreeing to any of these debates, so far. And I must express my dismay at Mr. Mulcair's statement that he would debate Harper anytime, anywhere. I only wish he could see that the only debate Harper will agree to will be an ambush. Harper has no honor. And knowing that I have questioned Mulcair's wisdom, it has been proffered that Harper is wanting the debates ahead of the writ time in hopes of capturing some gotcha moment and then using it in the cons' ad campaign during the election. And the arrogance of the cons. When asked about why they have refused to agree with traditional debates, well, con spokesman Corey Janiak said, and I quote, "We're going to pick the five that we think are going to be the best five, and the consortium just didn't make the cut, unfortunately for them." I read that as either the consortium were not willing to give the cons an unfair advantage, or the cons thought it quite equitable, and our party may not look good, so we've decided to do debates that will make us shine, no matter how we perform. And you know, on the one hand, I must admire their honesty. We have seen for years how the cons are not interested in participating in politics, but only in rigging it, in controlling it, in manipulating it. The traditional debates seems to be risky, too democratic. The contrast between the leaders is very stark. You have, and again I think this is a virtue to a fault, but nonetheless a virtue, with Mulcair, the leader of the NDP, stating debate is good for democracy, and he will debate anywhere, anytime. And the more debates, the more Canadians know about the issues, about the party platforms, the better it is for the nation. Then you have Trudeau, who is not so much a defender of democracy than a tradition. That said, he has the most principled stand. It has been reported that one of the conditions the Liberals are demanding for their participation in debates is that every party leader in the House should participate. That would ensure a seat for the Greens and the Bloc, people who seem to be left out of the debates in the new arrangements pioneered by the cons. And on that note, I should take a moment to point out how important the debates are for the smaller, non-traditional parties. I would remind you of the strong showing by Elizabeth May in the 2008 debates, debates the cons and the NDP tried to have her excluded from because although a leader of a party that received over 5% of the votes in Canada, the Greens still had no elected member in the House. Anyway, she was allowed to participate in the debates, and that likely helped propel the visibility of the Green Party so that she was elected a seat in the House in the 2011 election. And here's an irony. Now the Greens have seats and leaders in the House, but they will not be allowed to participate in the debates. Another example of poisoning of democracy by Harper and his Conservatives, and Canada's regression at his hands. So arrogant are the cons, the debate negotiator stated that, when asked about Harper not participating in the traditional debate, he had the gall to say, and again I quote, "The Prime Minister is the Prime Minister. He's leading the polls right now. And if the opposition leaders want to debate the Prime Minister, they know where he is." And this goes with an infamous quote by Harper to his inner circle, that the, quote, "longer he is Prime Minister, the longer he'll be Prime Minister." We see the true meaning now. The longer I have the power to rig the election, the easier it will be to remain in power. And this leads to another disturbing trend this election. A number, possibly all the debates, will be held outside the actual election period. As mentioned earlier, an election begins with the dropping of the writ. That is when the government is technically dissolved or dismissed by the Governor General, and campaigning begins, with the campaign ending with the actual vote. On the one hand, parties have done much campaigning outside this election period, but never before has it been so overt. Most elections are called on a whim, a spur of the moment. There was little time for pre-election electioneering. And this pre-election advertising is important because once an election is called, there are strict regulations on campaign spending, advertising, and the like, rules that don't apply to these activities outside this period. So we're seeing another example of the cons attempting to cheat. The In-N-Out scandal would not have been illegal if done outside the election period. One must wonder if robocalls would be illegal if done outside the election period. And we are being bombarded with new, quote, Government of Canada ads, which promote ministers talking to regular Canadians about the bang-up job they have done, implicating that the voters should sort of continue the success by maybe, I don't know, voting Conservative. First, these acts are illegal, or they should be. I know some people are actually investigating this. Why, you might ask? Well, it's against the law to run party ads paid for by the public purse. Essentially, these are Conservative campaign ads being paid for by our dollars. Jean-Pierre Kingsley, former head of Elections Canada, expressed these fears about pre-election campaigning in a recent interview in the CBC. He said, quote, "The Prime Minister is sham, and his people are setting the rules. I think every Canadian should be concerned about that. During an election campaign, the 36 days of the campaign is on, the parties can only spend so much, approximately $20 million. Candidates can only spend up to $80,000. But if they're allowed to start campaigning before the official start of the campaign now, then what they're doing is spending more money. Who's favored by this? The people with more money. Eventually, what you're going to see is an erosion of the financial controls that Canada has been developing over several generations. When we lose financial controls, we lose the ability to maintain what we call the level playing field, which is at the very core of our Electoral Act." That's what he has to say. And I have to say, let's connect the dots. We know that thanks to the generous gifts the cons have given to big money, like financially via tax cuts or subsidies and legislatively via relaxed regulation and free trade, well, that can be counted on to elicit big donations. And the richest party is the Cons, an advantage they're angling to make as advantageous as possible. The head of Elections Canada also agrees that election debates are another problem, as we have already said. He agrees that what we have now is one party changing the rules for its own political advantage. But what we should have is establish an independent regulator, an elections debate commissioner, if you will, to act as a watchdog who would consult with the parties and work with the traditional and emerging media to determine the number and the nature of the debates. This would take this pillar of democracy, this seminal event in every election, out of the hands of politicians and ensure the functioning of the debates. Their overreaching concerns is not political gain, but the public good. 2015, never forget. We'll be back after this break.
Science is the best tool ever devised for understanding how.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@RadioFreethinker.com.
And we're back. We've got a little bit from our Prairie correspondents about the true cost of tax cuts and why paying taxes is actually kind of a good thing. Let's listen in.
Few people like to pay taxes, but some of us really, really don't like paying them. It's often opined taxes are a necessary evil. And I've often wondered just how that's so. So I went looking for answers. The taxes do for me. And I found a lot, it turns out. I first want to premise that with a lot of us, me included, only basically see the tax, how much I'm required to pay. There's also the question, are my taxes going to pay for what I'm told they will? I can only say I hope. We elect our representatives, and we have to place some trust in their ability to do as they say. And of course, there's always another election 4 years down the road, and we could kick the lying bums out. Okay, so I can see tax deduction, but what's not so apparent are the benefits afforded me. Services I sort of take for granted because I don't have to open my wallet every time I access them. Taxes are a way of paying for a civilized nation. When there's a fire, we call the fire department to put it out. That's paid for with taxes. Our policemen keep our streets safe. The justice system is paid for with taxes. Our taxes fund agencies that keep our food safe and our water clean for drinking. Our tax dollars are used to enforce rules and oversight for commerce, provide safe working environments for workers, and those wonderful parks that provide us with vacation spots and great learning experiences with nature. One of the sites I ventured to estimates each Canadian receives about $40,000 worth of services. And I was surprised because, as I said, I just go and use the service. I seldom think of what it costs. Every generation has paid their taxes, and that's provided for schools, hospitals, roads, and public transit for the generations that follow. We haggle about taxes that fund social programs. A lot of us partly because we never, or may never, cross your fingers, use them. But by paying for those who do, through our taxes, we save a pile of money down the road. Social ills left untreated only get worse, and then they affect our lives, as well as those suffering under the load of disadvantage. There's a misconception that public employees are somehow lazier, less productive, and make way more money than those in private enterprise. And that's simply a misconception. On the whole, our government works pretty well. Public employees work diligently and are often doing vast amounts of work out of the public eye. Work on scene is often thought undone. They simply have fair wage and work standards, lacking in the private sectors. And why are private companies compensating their employees so poorly when they make huge profits? It shouldn't be a rush to the bottom. We should assure all Canadians have a decent life. Taxes aid in the leveling off of society by mellowing the disparities with wealth and power. Taxes allow citizens and businesses to build things together, things an individual could never accomplish on their own. Taxes provide our standard of living, our enjoyment in life, and our ability to sustain and advance our civilization. After my little jaunt into the world of cyber and the things I discovered about what my and your taxes pay for, and a glimpse of what life would be like without them, I'm still not dancing the fandango, but I feel a lot better about paying them. Governments change, as does taxation. An important thought to keep in mind, when a government promises to cut taxes, we all lose. We all pay more in the long run. Instead of paying for services collectively, we pay individually. And that ends up costing a lot more than pooling the pot. Beware of the government that uses tax reduction as an election ploy. Tax reduction means service reduction. Reduction in health care funding. Reduction in assistance to veterans who sacrifice their healthy bodies in defending our way of life. Reduction or curtailing pensions earned and deserved by a previous generation. Reduction in education and safety through reduction of law enforcement. And cuts back on firefighters as well as paramedics. A reduction in work safety and environmental funding on our water, food, and air. A reduction in parks and wildlife. Is the short-sighted monetary gain to a few worth the enormous detrimental impact on Canadian ethics as a whole? 2015. Never forget.
Very interesting. I plan to expand upon this whole idea about taxes and why they're actually good later on in a more fleshed out segment. But for the moment, let's take another break.
Did you know that the UBC Bookstore collects food for the AMS Food Bank? If you would like to contribute, please bring your non-perishable food items to the bookstore and drop them off in the box near the front cash area. For more information, check out ams.ubc.ca under Services.
And we're back. I heard recently that Canada Post union members have been going door to door to help explain to Canadians about how Harper's decided to get rid of home delivery in favor of super boxes, which might honestly be super theft boxes, but time will tell on that. But I was inspired and I remembered I did a fairly good segment on this about a year ago. So I'm going to rebroadcast that just to remind people in this election year how Harper has fucked us yet again by trying to close down Canada Post. Let's listen in. There has been much ado about the announcement by Canada Post that, in an effort to improve the health of Canadians, door-to-door delivery would be stopped so as to force Canadians to jog to a super box. This would put Canadians in tip-top shape. The Crown Corporation had to take these measures because obviously Canadians weren't exercising without an incentive. Now, we have covered this before on the show, but perhaps a little background. It was announced by the CEO of Canada Post, a Deepak Chopra, and no, not that Deepak. Anyway, he said that the Crown Corporation would cease daily delivery to private residences as of 2019. That people who now receive mail at their door would be forced to use community boxes. It was also announced that the price of a regular stamp would rise by about 60%, from 63 cents to 100 pennies. Yes, the best way to drive customers to your product is to increase its price. Sure, it works for Apple, but the iPad has a sexier image. But with Apple, you can choose to buy it or not. Canada Post is an essential service. I emphasize the word service. In many places, there would be no choice, like the railroad or the bus lines, at this point anyway. There would also be a significant reduction in staff, with about 8,000 jobs lost. Now, it is true, most of these will be through attrition, that is, not hiring replacements when current employees retire or quit. However, here again, you aggravate the problem, not solve it. Cutting staff to improve Canada Post is like trying to treat a broken arm by cutting your leg. The ostensive reason for this was because Canada Post was losing money. Deepak stated that the corporation endured a $134 million loss during the first 9 months of the year, and that it expected to deliver a billion fewer items in 2013 than 2006. It has been reported that the Conference Board of Canada issued a report saying that by 2020, Canada Post will be running an annual $1 billion deficit. Sounds pretty grim. Maybe the tax cuts are needed if they're to keep the corporation out of the red, or to put it in a way that Harperites would understand, make sure the taxpayers are not on the hook. Well, there are several things wrong with this. First, it is important to note that the losses are based on third-term reports. This is the pre-Christmas rush. A little side note here. Many of us have heard about Black Friday. And note, this has become a shopping day sort of akin to Boxing Day. Why do they call it Black Friday? Well, that is the day when businesses turn from running a loss, denoted in a red font color, to a profit, black. So everything up until that day was just paying for the lights, staff, products, mortgages, etc. Every dollar after that day is profit. Black Friday happens in the fourth quarter and just after the third quarterly report. You do not get a true picture until the annual report, which, based on previous years, should be out any day now. According to 2012 numbers, the corporation was running a $74 million loss third quarter, but finished up with a $131 million profit. So claims of the post office losses are a tad preemptive. Likely, the Crown Corporation is not losing money at all. The Conference Board report was commissioned by Canada Post, and a board member is the same Deepak. This is not a condemnation in and of itself, but when we try and fathom why the rhetoric does not match the numbers, well, this is just interesting. So the Conference Board did predict a $1 billion loss based on its estimations. However, the report was released April of 2012 before the annual report, and it stated the Crown Corporation would have a net operating loss of $250 million for 2012. As already stated, they had a net profit of $131 million. This makes the confidence in their forecasting laughable. So why would Deepak make the assertion that Canada Post is in the red? Well, it's based on the assumption that if Canada Post shut its doors tomorrow, it would still be liable for all its employees' pensions. Factoring in this expense, well then yes, Canada Post is running a deficit. But honestly, there's no way Canada Post is going to shut its doors anytime soon. Another questionable stat that has been thrown around is that, well, only a third of people get home delivery now anyway, so what's the big deal? Well, as it turns out, this is a yes and no answer. About 34% of Canadians get home delivery, but 24% of the population get apartment delivery, and then add another 4% for rural delivery. So the actual number of people getting direct mail delivery, note the shift from home to direct, it turns out that about 62% of people get direct mail delivery. People like me, I live in an apartment. I don't get door delivery, but I do get building delivery. If you dig into numbers, that means I will not be able to go to my lobby and grab my mail, but will have to go to some super box on the street corner, maybe a block or two away, and get my mail. So when the privatizers say an end to door-to-door delivery equates to people living in a single dwelling house will not get the privilege of service, no. What this means is people in a house, apartment, will no longer have door delivery. This will affect the majority of people and not some minority like the privatizers would have you believe. I question the motives in the proponents in their claim that the changes are focused only on house delivery while ignoring the fact that likely two-thirds of Canadians will be affected by these changes. Now, it is true that letter mail delivery is an all-time low, but parcel delivery is an all-time high, and that's a much more profitable venture. Thank you, Amazon and eBay. It is life's irony that as letter mail, as in correspondence, bills, etc., well, that as they decline, parcel post has increased exponentially. Those of us in the retail biz know all too well that more and more people are using brick-and-mortar stores to sample the product and then order the product online. This trend, although bad for some, is a godsend to companies like Canada Post. This strength is amplified when one discovers that Canada Post is 91% owner of Purolator. Together, this makes Canada Post the number one courier service in Canada and one of the largest ones in North America. In fact, if you look at the numbers, Canada Post has been running a profit every year this millennia, except for one where there was a double whammy of a labor strike and a pay equity ruling. One must ask, with a conservative government that is supposedly fiscally responsible, let's ignore the F-35 jet, the costly frigates, or the promotion of the Canada Jobs Grant that didn't actually exist, well, the conservative brand should like Canada Post because it makes money for the government, thus allowing them to lower taxes for the elite or to provide free helicopter rides for Peter McKay or what have you. Now, one could speculate as to why the CEO of Canada Post may want to shout gloom and doom for the company he heads. Well, this is where that conference board report comes into play. The lead recommendation of the board's report was to privatize the Crown Corporation. Remember, DPAC is a member of that board. It is not a secret that Harper and his conservatives are free market advocates. This move by DPAC provides a future justification for privatizing Canada Post. Okay, but that's all speculation. Let's take the report as real, what we philosophy types like to call the counterfactuals. Let's assume right now that Canada Post is losing money. Is this the end of Canada Post? Well, it must be acknowledged that snail mail has been on a decline over the past decades. That said, the speed of that decline has leveled off. There's just so much you can do online, and people still get those flyers about the weekly sales at Safeways, etc. Really, how many of us, even millennials, go online before heading to the supermarket? Exactly. So some regular post will always be necessary. We're at the bottom of the decline. Maybe, maybe not, but the trend does seem to point to a plateau. There's also the fact that as a Crown Corporation, it is not intended to be a profitable company, but to provide a service Canadians deem as primary or essential. So let's assume that mail delivery is losing money. The corporation itself makes up that loss by the profits it gains in Parcel Post, both from its own ownership, but remember it also owns Purolator. And even if it did not, well, to say it again, the whole point of a Crown Corporation is to provide a needed and necessary service where a for-profit company could not operate. Many seniors are not likely to, quote, go online anytime soon, and there are various reasons why people, regardless of age, are not comfortable with online. So one could argue, who cares if it makes a small loss? Its value to regular Canadians is worth it. Not convinced by that argument? Okay, let's assume again that Canada Post is losing money and something must be done. What are the options? Well, one could sell off yet another crown jewel of the nation to private interests, which we all know it will eventually become some subsidiary of some American or foreign corporation, which will likely for us, okay, speculation here, but you know it's not going to be good for us citizens. Another option is to expand the services Canada Post offers. The services that they could provide, well, they're already do in some locations. They provide auxiliary government services, such as passport renewal, student loan negotiation. However, the most talked about expansion of Canada Post service is into an area called postal banking. One of the most persistent ideas to arise is to follow many other nations and create a postal bank. That is, have Canada Post not only deliver mail, but also financial services. Currently, Canadians pay about $200 a year just for the privilege of letting a bank use your money. Remember, your deposits are what allow banks to make loans and the like. Few banks now acquire the majority of their gains from interest on loans, but from bank fees and other financial services. One last note. Some people may be aware of a thing called financial fringe institutions. These are businesses anywhere from a payday loan lender to Canada Tire credit cards to the President's Choice Bank. Funny, Pres Choice is advertising something they call debankifying, which I'm going to stretch to be an endorsement for postal banking. Now, these do provide alternatives to traditional banks. However, they all have a catch. Entities like Canadian Tire are not in it to provide a service, but to use credit to channel more sales to its retail outlets. Entities like payday lenders, well, I've already complained about the high bank fees and interest rates. A payday loan of $280 for 10 days carries a processing fee of $64.40, or an interest rate of about 840%. Can you say loan shark? It's important to note that it's a fee and not a rate of interest. Federal law does cap interest rates to 60% annually. Although we have a modern banking system, it's a for-profit system. That means if your business is not profitable, they will not serve you. There's been a 29% decline in the number of bank branches since 1990. A majority of that decline is felt in smaller communities, where postal banking would be deemed an essential, not a nice-to-have. That is, if they need to deposit, withdraw, or what have you, they must go to larger centers. It is estimated that as many as 15% of Canadians don't actually have a banking account. Why? Canada Post has an advantage over the regular banking system. They're everywhere. Where it costs money to open up a TD branch in Dauphin, Manitoba, there's a post office there already, which could provide both banking and postal services. This is not a uniquely Canadian idea either. In fact, most progressive nations have postal banks, the largest being Japan Post, with over $2 trillion in deposits. The fifth largest bank in China is a postal bank. UK, France, Italy, Switzerland, and New Zealand all have publicly owned postal banks. New Zealand's Kiwi Bank, which is part of their postal service, was created in 2001. It could be a model for a resurgent Canadian postal bank. I should mention that the main proponents of this are not people wishing more banking services, but want to provide a way to maintain a national postal service. It is a happy coincidence that saving Canada Post will also help improve our financial industry, which is one of the most concentrated in the world, and it will also make people's lives better. There are many models around the world that we could follow. Some involve creating a charter bank, partnering with existing banks, or allowing Canada Post Bank, in scare quotes, do financial transactions with existing accounts from other banks, sort of think of ATM machine. As it turns out, there's already legislation for the creation of a post office savings bank. In fact, for over a century, there has been the legal framework for a postal bank. The legislation to create the bank was passed in 1868. In 1908, the postal bank had the equivalent of $1 billion in deposits. And when it was shut down in 1969, it had almost 300,000 accounts. It was closed down largely thanks to lobbying by the charter banks to ensure that they had an advantage over things like interest rates. It is also interesting to note that although the bank itself does not operate, the legislation for its operation still exists, so we wouldn't really even need to pass a new law. One of the ways they can compete with, quote, mature banking system would be to provide a bank fee system based on real cost. It has been documented many times that bank fees do not reflect the cost of doing business, but are seen as a profit center. A non-profit bank, like a Canada Post Bank, could provide a place to keep your money without exorbitant banking fees. It can also be a mechanism for the Canadian government to provide essential services to low-income people. It is estimated that 8% of Canadians have never had any bank account. Postal banking could provide one. They could also offer low-income people access to loans or mortgages to help lift people out of the poverty cycle. This would be an essential tool for First Nation people who often are left out of the commercial banking opportunities. Okay, what are Canada Post's advantages? Well, as of 2012, there are about 6,000 bank branches in Canada. Canada Post has more outlets than all the other banks combined, and 60% of those are in rural locations. The hours of operation for most post offices are better than those offered by commercial banks. Canada Post, as a Crown corporation, is a trusted brand. As part of the government, they could provide a low-cost way of providing services such as student loan issuing credit cards that reflect real interest rates. So instead of paying up to 30% interest, where the base lending rate is less than 5%, a prudent but more affordable level of maybe 15%. At cost or near cost mortgages for low-income people, small business loans, insurance products, even things like mutual funds, CBC Marketplace points out that our banks charge the highest fees in the world for mutual funds. They would also have a sanitizing effect on being transparent. That is, I've already mentioned that bank fees do not reflect real cost. A Canada Post bank could make such claims obvious. A postal bank, like in other countries, could provide banking services to commercial banks as well. That is, they could allow you to do your banking transaction from your TD or Royal Bank of Canada account at a postal bank. Some people also propose that postal banks could provide low-cost credit cards, prepaid debit cards, and special First Nation loans or low-income mortgages. They could also provide low-cost alternative services for NGOs and the like. NGOs often find it difficult to work with traditional banks because of the innate messiness of an NGO. Issues revolving around the fluctuating personnel base, think volunteers, management that is often in flux, the reliability of donations, and other issues provide barriers to NGOs operating well. Canada Post could provide a social banking service that could run at cost, something the regular banks won't do. So let's run down again the advantages Canada Post has if it provided banking services. 1. It already has thousands of retail outlets. 2. Canada Post goes everywhere, so a significant number of those outlets are in places where little or no regular banking services is provided. Surveys show that not only do we trust the Post Office because it's a Crown Corporation, its transparency can be legislated. It has highly trained and motivated employees. One of the biggest backers of this idea, obviously so, are the unions. Many postal outlets are open 7 or 6 days a week, and the hours are longer than traditional banks. Canada Post already has experience in delivering financial services such as money orders, international transfers, and more. It could partner up with existing federal finance entities such as the Farm Credit Canada, Business Development Bank of Canada, Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation, Export Development Canada, Savings Bonds, and more. Postal banks around the world have not only provided a lifeline to the postal institution, but have shown to be both a profit center for government as well as providing necessary services that traditional banks could not or would not provide. Now, what are the chances of a Harper government allowing Canada Post to diversify? Next to none. Although the NDP and the Green Party are in favor of such a move, the Liberals have been noticeable in their silence. They were the ones that shut it down in 1969 during Trudeau the Senior's government. Trudeau Jr., we don't know. So Harper has a history of trying to diminish Canada's public institutions. One can only assume to provide a reason for future privatization. Think Atomic Energy of Canada. They're the ones that make the CANDU reactors sold around the world. The CBC, Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation. And of course, there is the selling of national landmarks, such as the Revenue Canada building and the Royal Canadian Mounted Police headquarters in Montreal. Perhaps he has intel about the possible Quebec sovereignty vote. And then they sold off the Government of Canada building, which I guess now is called the former Government of Canada building. And rumors abound that there are plans to sell the Lester B. Foreign Affairs building, which only houses the Department of Foreign Affairs and the National Library and Public Archives. The feckin' archives, people. Now, I will give the devil his due. He has yet to actually privatize any of our Crown corporations, but he has a history of denigrating them. Can the P word be far behind? He is like setting up for the next Conservative Prime Minister by sending these corporations into a death spiral. How does doubling the price of a letter make it likely more people will send them make sense? Anyway, this death spiral will mean that they will fail eventually, and the only solution Conservatives will provide? Privatization. There's been a bit said in the popular media, but most of it's focused on the myths surrounding Canada Post. What myths? Let's recap those as well. 1. Canada Post service cuts and cost increases are necessary because it is no longer profitable. Response: Canada Post is responsible for every year but one, 2011, since 1997. Look it up on their website. Letter traffic is decreasing so much that a profitability crisis is inevitable. According to Canada Post, the internet is to blame. Yes, letters are down, but parcel post is up, thanks to all that online shopping. Blame the internet again. The $6.5 billion shortfall in Canada Post pension plan is a time bomb that can destroy the company. Yes and no. That bomb only goes off if the Crown Corporation shuts its doors today. It is in fine shape to pay the pensions of its employee. In fact, the Crown Corporation is better funded vis-a-vis its pensions than most private companies. Service cuts and increasing costs are about saving Canada Post. This only puts the Crown Corporation in a death spiral. Again, I ask, how is reducing service and upping costs going to drive more people to send letters? 5. Community superboxes, which are to replace door-to-door delivery in urban areas, are safe and accessible. There's a lot to debunk here on this one, folks. First, community superboxes, for those who do not know, are similar to postal boxes you see in like your local post office or 7-Eleven, but they're located outdoors with no supervision or monitoring. The fact that they are both no longer supervised and have gathered people's mail into a sort of one-stop pickup, well, makes them prime target for vandals and thieves. Why go to the effort of stealing mail from 30 separate mailboxes when you can have the convenience of one superbox? Look online for how often this occurs, and think how more often it will happen when everyone is relegated to a superbox. For thieves, one-stop pickup becomes one-stop shopping. A CBC report revealed that there were 4,880 incidences of vandalism, arson, and theft from these superboxes between 2008 and 2013. And of course, let's not forget that many Canadians have limited mobility. That is making the daily trek to the superboxes nearly impossible. Of course, Canada Post CEO said it will provide an opportunity for these people to engage in more exercise. Seriously? A typical ignorant remark from an unthinking and uncaring person of power who obviously does not grasp the gravity of the plight of those affected. Beyond the supposed exercise, as we live in colder clime, issues such as snow and ice buildup around boxes provide extra hurdles for those of limited mobility. 6. Canada Post must have done consultations before deciding to cut services and raise postal rates. No, Canada Post management kept both its workers and the public in the dark. They announced the cuts and the service cost increase the day after Parliament retired for the holidays. They have mentioned feedback from consultations, but have provided no specific incidences of the same, so no evidence that any real consultation with Canadians was ever attempted. 7. There's no privatization agenda at Canada Post. This is just my lefty agenda rearing its ugly head. Well, as mentioned, CEO Deepak Chopra sits on the board of Conference Board of Canada. The Conference Board of Canada wrote a paper that favored the wholesale privatization of Canada Post. The paper even used faulty arguments and figures to justify privatization. In other words, sound and carefully gathering of facts was dispensed with in favor of an ideologically driven idea. Oh yes, let's not forget that this is also an attack on unions. By reducing the unionized workers at Canada Post by half, well, that only strengthens the hands of Harper conservatives. Okay, so let's wrap this up. Canada Post is a public service. It is owned by all Canadians. It should serve Canadians as an affordable and effective communication delivery system, not as a cash cow for private interests at the expense of the public. There's another advantage not often mentioned in the postal bank debate, but Canada Post, in one way or another, reaches every Canadian. This means that they could provide not only home delivery of mail, but home delivery of banking services. Imagine, door-to-door banking. In an election year, it's as relevant now as it was then. We'll be right back after this break.
Stephen Harper's reckless cuts to home mail delivery are hurting the most vulnerable in our society. Senior citizens and those with mobility issues are disproportionately affected by these cuts, all while Canada Post is making millions of dollars in profit. Postal workers are campaigning to protect quality jobs and public services in our communities. The post office belongs to you. Join the fight today at SaveCanadaPost.ca.
And we're back. I've a big fan of Rick Mercer, and especially Rick's rants. And, well, I've got a bit of extra time this week, so I'm going to play you a series of Rick's rants that I think are not only informative, but funny, but ultimately informative. So, let's listen in.
I love the Samara Institute. They're an amazing charity. Their entire reason for being is to inspire Canadians to become more involved in democracy. What's not to love? They aren't stuffy. They've got a great sense of humor. If you love politics, you can spend hours on their website. But if you love democracy, it can be kind of depressing. Their latest report card is out and it's clear. If Canadian democracy was a patient, it would be in the hallway on a gurney on its way to palliative care. Turns out the majority of Canadians are completely disgusted by Canadian politics. If this keeps up, the only people who will ever vote are the base. And the base, by the way, no matter which party you're talking about, are a group of blindly loyal drones who live to get a Christmas card from their MP. As I said, fairly depressing. But there is good news. Canadians are incredibly active and generous. A healthy majority gives money to charity or devotes time to causes they believe in. They want to be engaged. They just don't want to be engaged to anyone on Parliament Hill. I just spent an entire week surrounded by young people aged 6 to 26 who want nothing more than to make the world a better place. But you suggest they join a political party? You might as well tell them to go slam their head in a locker. When it comes to politics, abstinence is on the rise. So to the leaders of the major political parties, this is go time. Canadians, especially young Canadians, they're just not that into you. There's less than 1 year until the next federal election. Please, look beyond your base, because democracy is far too important to sacrifice to partisan politics. It seems like yesterday that I was walking in this alley talking about the state of the Canadian Senate. But in fact, it was many months ago. And Canada was a far more innocent place back then. Back then, we were finding out that Senator Mike Duffy, Stephen Harper's favorite fundraiser, did not in fact live on PEI. The RCMP investigated. Turns out his official residence is somewhere in the Prime Minister's lower colon. But who could have guessed? Who could have guessed that once we pulled on that thread, that the Prime Minister's universe could unravel so much? Senator Pam Wallen, another favorite. Turns out she's been spending so much time billing taxpayers for personal airline travel, not only is she not officially a resident of Saskatchewan, she is not technically a resident of Earth. The Prime Minister's chief of staff resigns in disgrace. The Prime Minister's former parliamentary secretary, Dean Del Mastro, charged with election fraud. Patrick Brazeau, Carolyn Stewart Olson. The alley is not long enough to keep going. But I was thinking, the Prime Minister appointed every one of these people. It should be statistically impossible to appoint that many train wrecks. Serious question. Has anyone checked the Prime Minister's office for lead pipes? Because it's like everyone close to that man has brain damage. Their moral compass has been destroyed. I'm mostly worried that it could be contagious, because if it is airborne, we're in serious trouble. Can you imagine if regular citizens started acting like these people? All hell would break loose. Suddenly people would start stealing from their employers and their churches, and they would become convinced that the normal rules did not apply to them. Red lights and green lights would be meaningless. Normally, when a group of people start to exhibit bizarre symptoms in a cluster, health officials are called in. So never mind the RCMP. It's time for a quarantine. Last week was one of those rare weeks where suddenly everyone was paying attention to the goings-on in Ottawa. And from a showbiz perspective, the House of Commons had it all. Scandal, betrayal, intrigue. The only thing missing was gratuitous nudity. And I was really thinking, you know what? The Prime Minister, the government, the MPs, they must be stoked because they know that for the first time in a long time, people are paying attention. They are going to bring their A game. No such luck. It's like they all got together and decided to intentionally ensure nobody would ever watch ever again. It's called question period. MPs get to stand up and ask the government questions, and they're supposed to get answers. It's there because a long time ago we decided it's an improvement over sword fights and dueling. But it is broken. It needs to be fixed. How about from now on? If someone asks the Prime Minister a question like, I don't know, say, Prime Minister, When you said that nobody in your office was aware of the secret payment to the senator, were you telling the truth, yes or no? He's got to answer the question. If he doesn't answer or he stands up and starts talking about trade deals, a giant red X appears on the screen and a buzzer goes off. I know it's not very elegant, but it's better than the system we have now. Now, when the Prime Minister avoids a question, his caucus, they leap to their feet and start cheering like little girls at a Justin Bieber mall appearance. Normally, I bemoan the fact that young people don't pay attention to politics. But you know what? Maybe it's a good thing because really, parliamentarians, you are a bad example to youth. If it's not acceptable at the dinner table, why is it acceptable at the House of Commons? I don't care what party is in power or who the Prime Minister is, but when you have a leader of a party that refuses to provide a straight answer to a straight question about something that happened on their watch, then it's time for that party to find a leader who will. Canada's Minister of Public Safety, Vic Taves, got some startling news recently. Vic found out that prisoners in our federal system, prisoners occasionally get permission from the wardens to pool their money and buy pizza out of their work accounts. Now, this is a big expense for prisoners because they make about $54 every 2 weeks. But then they take the pizza and resell it to the inmates who have already paid for it, and they make money on the whole deal. And then it gets worse, and this is the part that Vic really hates. They take that money and they give it to charity. Boys and Girls Club, CNIB, UNICEF, something called the Children's Wish Foundation of Canada, which, let's face it, sounds very suspicious. Well, when Vic heard this, he hit the roof. He wrote the head of Corrections Canada, said this was ridiculous, this was coddling prisoners, the whole thing must come to an end. And I do not blame him, because it is a slippery slope, my friends. If there are prisoners out there raising money for school lunch programs, that is coming dangerously close to contributing to society. God knows where that type of behavior might end. Next thing you know, they might start obeying laws. And you know where that leads? Paying taxes. I feel bad for Vic. I really do. There are a lot of problems in prison, and he's got to deal with them. There's drugs, violence, gangs, and now this. Evidence that the desire to do good can exist in the most horrible of places. Well, not anymore, my friends. Not in this country. Time to nip that in the bud. Charity starts at home, but it stops with Vic. There's nothing I hate more than those situations where the more I read, the more confused I become. Welcome to the Canadian economy. 5 minutes ago, the government was crystal clear. It was all about the oil. It was practically government policy that every firstborn child in Canada should become a pipe fitter. And if anyone dared suggest that our economy was too dependent on oil, they were nothing less than an enemy of the state. And now, the price of oil has tanked, the world is dumping our currency, and the Prime Minister is showing up in Ontario, of all places, talking about manufacturing. Yes, Alberta, I hate to break it to you, but Big Daddy's flirting around Eastern Canada saying, oil, schmoil, I barely knew her. Give him another week, he'll be admitting he was born and raised in Toronto. This is why I am so confused. The Bank of Canada says low oil is very bad for Canada, all of Canada, and yet the government is saying there are tax breaks for the wealthy coming and everything is on budget. But oh, wait. There is no budget. How can there be no budget? You know why there's no budget? Because behind the dull eyes of the finance minister is a brain melting in full-blown panic. Look, I lived in Newfoundland before the collapse of the fishery. I understand how upset people in Alberta are, but one thing we know is no matter what happens, we will get through this together. As sure as the sun will rise, the sun will set, and there are very expensive commercials on TV paid for by us telling us, wait for it, our economy is the envy of the world. I found it very unnerving a few weeks ago when the Parliamentary Secretary to the Minister of Defence announced that our Navy, the Canadian Navy, had been confronted by a Russian warship. This is very serious stuff. And then the next day, Jason Kenney, our new Minister of Defence, he upped the ante and revealed that a Russian fighter jet buzzed a Canadian frigate in the Black Sea at a low altitude. This is a very scary development. These are acts of aggression. And Kenny, my goodness, he's like Winston Churchill, Billy Bishop, and General Hillier all wrapped up in one. Thank God for his leadership, I thought. Eyes of a cougar. And then NATO officials weighed in. You remember NATO. They're the ones running this operation. And they said, oh, yeah, none of that actually happened. It's all made up. Okay, kids, come out from under the school desk. According to NATO, our ships were overflown by surveillance aircraft at a high altitude 128 kilometers away. I have an outrageous question. Who's lying here? Someone's lying. The Minister of Defense, NATO, they both have completely different stories. Imagine if the fire department came out tomorrow and said, there's a firebug in our neighborhood trying to burn down all the schools. We would be alarmed. Then imagine if the police came out and said, actually, the fire department made that up. They got a new chief over there. He's hoping to get his name in the paper this week. There would be hell to pay. At the very least, there would be an investigation. But I guess when it comes to the little things in this world, like committing troops, going to war, or getting into a size contest with Vladimir Putin, it's okay to play with the truth. Honestly, I don't know who's lying here, but I can't believe that in Canada, the truth has become a casualty we no longer care about. When a 3 or 4-year-old takes candy from the corner store and puts it in their pocket without paying for it, we all understand it's not the end of the world. And we also understand that if that child has parents with a moral compass, on that day that child will learn the lesson that stealing is wrong. Because in our society, if you take something that does not belong to you without permission, it is theft. It does not matter who you are. Oh. Unless, of course, you're the Conservative Party of Canada, who recently floated the idea of changing Canada's copyright laws. And not to protect people who need the laws or to create jobs. No, no. They want to change the laws to allow political parties, them specifically, to take news footage that they don't own, to take that footage, to re-edit it, slow it down, add creepy music, create attack ads. Well, in this country, you just can't do that to footage without permission. No matter how tempting the candy is, because it is stealing. If Global TV, a private news outfit, invests time, energy, resources, and money landing an exclusive interview, another news network can't take that footage and put it on TV because they don't own it. A charity can't put that on TV because they don't own it. There are no exceptions. To quote a very popular document, "Thou shalt not steal." I know Stephen Harper has been accused of having a hidden agenda, but I didn't think it involved circumventing the Ten Commandments. Stealing is wrong. If the Tories allow this to go through, every single Tory MP should have to write a letter to the children in their ridings explaining to them why the next time they're in a store, if they think they can get away with it and no one's looking, take all the candy you want. Do you ever have those days where you feel like there's a higher power whose entire purpose is to constantly test your grip on reality? You know those days where you wake up and you hear that Pierre Poilievre has been chosen by Prime Minister Harper to reform democracy in Canada? I mean, on a day like that, it's entirely normal to think I must be hallucinating. Because I guarantee you, you get any member of the Conservative caucus alone in a room and you ask them, who is the last man on earth who should be put in charge of reforming democracy? And they will tell you, Pierre Poilievre. But the Prime Minister gave him a job to do, and boy, has he done it. He has tabled the Fair Elections Act. And I promise you, if you read this bill, you will feel like you have left Canada and slipped into a parallel universe. When this bill passes, it will be illegal for Elections Canada to encourage young people to vote because... Well, there's the problem right there, isn't it? I mean, you get young people voting, next thing you know, you have an entire generation of informed citizens running around, taking part in democracy and feeling a real ownership in Canada. Now, if you ask the government, they will tell you voter turnout in Canada is at an historic low, and therefore that's proof that encouraging people to vote does not work. Not true. People do not vote because they look at the way that politics is being performed in Canada and they feel like they've been given a feed of bad oysters. After that, they just avoid the buffet altogether. Canadians, we love to brag that we are one of the world's greatest democracies. If we abandon the principle that voting is important and must be encouraged, we forfeit the title. Which great political leader was it who said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself? Well, you can Google later, but we know for certain it was not Stephen Harper. He loves to remind us over and over again that danger is lapping at our shores. And these days, there's a lot of things to be afraid of. The government and the media are constantly telling us that terrorism is at the top of that list. And so it should be. But that is just the tip of the iceberg. You want to go down the fear road, there's a lot of things we should be afraid of. Danger is not just lapping at our shores, it's in the bathroom. Do you have any idea how many bad things can happen to you in the bathroom? People die in there every year, hundreds of them. And I, for one, I would welcome it if from now on in every speech the Prime Minister gave, he would go on at length about the dangers of slip and fall. And any discussion about the economy should be met with tough talk on how to keep us safe in the bathroom. And we need new powers, new laws, forcing Canadians to use those rubber bath mats. And there is no time to debate these laws. And obviously, the state will need new powers to enter the bathroom. If Peter McKay or Jason Kenney wants in your toilet, upstairs or down, that is a small price to pay. And while we're on the subject, do you have any idea how many Canadians are killed every year in the summer doing summer things? It is our deadliest season, and yet we are encouraged to go outdoors. That needs a rethink. If you go online and you research all the frightening things in this world, you will realize Stephen Harper is right. We have every reason to be afraid. But if we give in to that fear, we would never debate a bill, go outdoors, or take a shower again.
That's all the time we have this week. This is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars, a still more glorious dawn.